Back together again, you and I chatting it up for a brand new week, kicking it off Monday, November 18th, 2024, right here on Connecticut Today. We open with my thoughts on the continued soul-searching by local, state, and national-level Democrats over this month's election results. CBS News correspondent Scott McFarland joined us to chat about the anticipated changes in the House for the upcoming session of Congress, while Connecticut News Junkie columnist and Substack.com blogger Terry Cowgill stopped by to offer more national and local post-election thoughts.
So, for a second weekend in a row, I'm seeing all this chatter on the national channels, the local channels, which of course carry the what are referred to in the business as the, you know, the Sunday gab shows, and soaking in kind of all the local stuff, listening to what the local people have to say. And you would think, by the reaction that we're seeing from the Connecticut State Democratic Party, from the Massachusetts Democratic Party, from locals in and about Bridgeport, you would think, honestly, because some of the stuff I'm reading is absolutely ridiculous, you would think that every Hispanic, Latino, Latina voter, African-American voter, Black voter, is suddenly a made member of MAGA. And you would think now the Democratic Party is crumbling, which it's not. And no, they're not all MAGA members. But boy, I got to tell you, the amount of stories popping up over the weekend, and we'll discuss this a little bit. This started last week with a couple of op-eds. But I'm reading some of this stuff here over the weekend and listening on national TV, but you know, on radio, but actually listening here and reading to people just like losing their, you know, stuff regarding the fact that Donald Trump did appreciably better with some Black and Hispanic voters than Democrats have been doing. And now there's this self-examination of the Democratic Party about Black and Hispanic voters. You know, this started last week with Chris Rosario's piece, that member of the State House delegation from Bridgeport, longtime Democrat, saying we've got to meet the needs of the Hispanic community better. What have you been doing for 50 or 60 years? And we hear this over the weekend. We're hearing this earlier today. You know, interesting article that was posted, I guess, over the weekend in the Republican American of Waterbury, you know, focusing on, you know, one voter there. Here's the headline. The Democrats kept talking, taking the community for granted. One Hispanic voter said, voters shift toward the GOP in Connecticut highlights a growing conservative appeal. And this is being covered like it's something that shouldn't happen. So you have this story here out of Waterbury. You had the Rosario op-ed last week. And now there's even, you know, there's quivering in Massachusetts. This one out of the Boston Globe. More Massachusetts Black voters are backing Trump. Dems want to know how they can re-energize the voting base. How they can re-energize the voting base? I'll give you that for free. Seriously, though, this weeping, this teeth gnashing or tooths gnashing or whatever, over the past week or so since the election, my God, get a grip. Grow a spine. Some of your policies stink. That's why there's an appeal for some. And again, it's not like Black and Hispanic voters are cascading to Donald Trump. Yeah, it was up appreciable amount with Hispanics, a few points in Blacks. But that's something that I've been saying, and a lot of folks like myself, you know, we've been saying for years and years, ain't going to take much, especially with the Black vote. And look what happened. Says here in this Boston Globe story, for decades, the Black electorate has been a reliable member of the Democratic Party's coalition, consistently throwing the vast majority of its voting power to the left. But over the past three cycles, there's been a slight shift right, particularly among black men who have increased their support of President-elect Donald Trump. The trend has confounded some local black leaders, blah, 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 who say they don't understand how black voters would support a candidate like that. Really? Really? So you don't want the black voters to get restless on the plantation? Is that what you're saying here? Know your place. I guess that's what black leaders are saying. Instead of respecting the decision that black and Hispanics have made and Latino and Latina voters, instead of respecting that decision and looking in the mirror, now some people are, but boy, I got to tell you something, you Democrats in Hartford, you Democrats in Bridgeport, Hartford, New Haven, Danbury, Waterbury, and all across the state of the country, I have an idea. How about looking in the mirror and answering me this question? What makes you think that what you're doing is so good for black voters and Hispanic voters? Really? Can you be more cavalier? Now, look, I'm not sitting here waving the Republican flag because of pox on their house, too. They pretty much gave up on the cities. And now, at least, you know, under the tutelage of Ben Proto, who's been on the show here a few times from the state Republican Party chair position, you know, maybe he's starting to foster that change a little bit. And you can start culling, you can start collecting, I should say, you know, more Republican votes out of the cities. Heck, 6,000 Trump votes in Waterbury. And you would think the world is ending with the state Democratic Party. You would think the world is ending. Now, again, you have these black leaders, this one here in Boston, saying they don't understand how black voters would support a candidate like Donald Trump or a Republican. Well, I got to tell you, let's do this, and I'll come back and tell you why maybe some black voters have had enough. Maybe. It's not a huge percentage. We're not talking another 15, 20, 30, 40%, or even Hispanic voters. But maybe if you Democratic power brokers in Bridgeport, in Hartford, in New Haven, and all across the Northeast in the U.S., maybe it's because now, finally, you have minority voters, Latinos, Latinas, and black voters saying, hey, you know what? Your policies stink. Malia Lazu, L-A-Z-U. Malia or Malia, I don't know. My apologies to Ms. Lazu. Never met her. A longtime community organizer and the CEO of the Lazu Group. This is in Massachusetts, said, quote, Democrats ran a race to the right, and in order to do that, we had to be silent on a lot of issues that we work on daily that people find passionate. What does that mean? That is a word salad. What in the heck, Ms. Lazu, are you talking about? You've been getting the overwhelming plurality of the Hispanic vote in Massachusetts, here in Connecticut, in just about every state in the country. She said, quote, this is a time to be honest about where we are because we could be moving in the wrong direction. Gee, thanks, Ms. Einstein. In 10 Massachusetts towns with the highest share of black residents, you know how much Donald Trump gained? Seriously. Black voters. And I don't think these numbers have come out yet for Connecticut, but our neighbor to the north here, Massachusetts, or some people used to call it Taxachusetts before they actually cut some taxes and we kept increasing ours. But that's another topic for another day. In 10 Massachusetts towns with the highest share of black residents, Donald Trump gained, on average, compared to 2020, 5.8 points. He gained a whole 6 points. That means if you go back to your basic elementary school math, kids, out of every 100 black voters, six of them shifted to Donald Trump. That means, see, I can do the inverse properties here, as they used to teach us that. That means you take 100%, you minus out 6%. That means you still have 94% of, in this case, black voters in the 10 highest municipalities in Massachusetts voting for Donald Trump, and they're acting like it was the San Francisco earthquake. in Brockton, where 2 in 5 residents are black. Mr. Trump improved to how much? 28% of the vote from, again, 22%. Look at that. 6 points. And you Democrats out there, my friends on the other side, you're acting here like this is some sort of seismic shift. And the party leaders, whether it's these people in Massachusetts or, you know, Nancy DiNardo here in Connecticut or Chris Rosario, who wrote that op-ed that made the rounds last week, you would think there's a 20-30 point shift. So you know what you have to do? Yeah, you need to look at yourselves in the mirror. And although you may be a fine-looking young man or young woman, or older, depending, you may not like what you see policy-wise. Well, what do the Republicans offer that could help minority neighborhoods, Paul? I don't know, maybe being tougher on crime? Maybe, geez, I don't know, making sure that multi-time offenders, especially with a gun, do more jail time? Why, you think black and Hispanic people in the middle of Bridgeport, Hartford, or New Haven want to see career gangbangers out on the streets more? You think they want their Kias or their Hyundais stolen any more than a white person wants that? You think a black or Hispanic parent or grandparent or anybody who's the who has purvey over a child, you think they would like, I don't know, vouchers to go to a better school to get their kid out of some rat hole school that may be falling apart? Yes. But that's something that the teachers' unions and the Connecticut Democrats always bitch and moan about. Giving any sort of a choice. I mean, they've moved a little bit on charter schools, but giving a black or a Hispanic resident of Bridgeport, Hartford, or New Haven, an actual shot at giving their kid or kids, as the case may be, a better education. Oh, can't have that. That's something Republicans like. So maybe, hopefully, and look, I'm under no mass illusion or delusion here that, oh, you know, you never know, you know, we're going to have black people voting 50 or 60% Republican again. No, that's not going to happen. But what have I been telling you for years and years and years on this show and other shows that I've done? In fact, I think I use the exact phrase here heading into the election. If 5% of the black vote, of the African-American vote, moves in any given election, watch out. Watch out. And now you get this idiocy coming out of Washington. Well, we're going to form a shadow cabinet to oppose Donald Trump. Yeah, you can oppose him. You know what the opposition is called? Congress. We should do what the Brits do. Oh, and the Brits are so stable. Love the Brits, but, oh, let's have another snap election. The Tories aren't good. Let's go with the Labor Party again every other year. 203. I'm sorry. 203-333-9422. 333-WICC. Oh, my God. The Democrats are going to, at least we've been hearing here in Connecticut and all around the nation, oh, we're going to re-examine our policies. My God. Your knees are knocking because you lost 5%. But again, what did I tell you? And maybe this should be an indication, maybe, to local Democrats in Bridgeport, Hartford, or New Haven, or statewide Democrats, Nancy DiNardo and company in Hartford, or maybe nationally, all the Democratic members of Congress who are Latino, Latina, or African-American, you know, maybe your policy positions are so antiquated and so out of step and so last century that you've backed yourself into a corner. Now let's trot you down to the nation's capital for a few minutes. Return visit here from Scott McFarland, CBS News. Hey, Scott, it's Paul. Good afternoon here. How are you?
Oh, it's good to be here. Thanks for having me.
Thanks, Scott, for taking the time. We know you're super busy, and I know you guys and gals in the D.C. press corps are keeping an eye on a lot of the new arrivals. Now, we saw a few in the Senate, but what is the situation here in the House? And has every district been decided yet, Scott, or do we still have a couple of trailers coming?
Still waiting for something out of California. California has a little bit of a different rhythm to them.
Yeah.
It's deliberate by design. They actually accept ballots a week after Election Day, if they're mailed, postmarked by or before Election Day. So it takes a while to do some tabulation. They also have a process they call ballot curing, which gives them the ability to make sure everybody's got everything buttoned up before the ballots are officially counted. So there's a few races in California. But beyond that, we know the baseline here. It's going to be a Republican-controlled U.S. House again, probably by about nearly the same margin Republicans had the last 2 years, which, as you remember, set the stage for a lot of gridlock and a lot of close calls on House floor votes. We expect that same dynamic to be true this time, although all of Washington is controlled by Republicans. Maybe that will smooth things out. Maybe.
Yeah, and we're looking at, I guess, a fear that was palpable and genuine, Scott. We heard over the weekend with you guys and on all the other networks, there are some Republicans telling the White House or the incoming White House, you know, hey, Mr. Trump, don't take too many of us here because we have, as you say, a razor-thin margin, and the closer you are in that margin usually means you have to make a lot more deal-making here.
That's right. And every single vote counts when the margins are this narrow. You think it's difficult to pass legislation when the House is narrowly divided? Now try taking one person away or two people away, and all of a sudden your margin for error is zero. And that's why there were so many of those government shutdown standoffs over the past couple of years, getting near the deadline without a deal because they didn't have margin for error. And with at least two members of the U.S. House slated to be nominees for Trump's cabinet, and a third who has just quit the U.S. House already in advance of being a nominee for Trump's cabinet, they're down to maybe just two or three votes to spare on any one thing. And let me tell you, you can't get unanimity in any conference if the sky is blue, much less on legislation.
Yeah, let's talk about the Matt Gaetz for the thing for a second. Scott McFarlane joins us from CBS News now. Matt Gaetz, and a lot of people, Scott, unlike you and I who get paid to follow this stuff, they may have heard that, oh, yeah, Matt Gaetz, I kind of, wasn't there something going on with him? And I guess we may never know what this House investigation has said about him. And I know there are some people out there saying, well, this was just a way to make sure that sucker didn't get released here. So explain Matt Gaetz to my listeners.
This is messy. You know, Matt Gaetz is now a former Florida congressman. He is among the most ardent, if not the most ardent, loyalist of Donald Trump in Congress over the past few years. He's the selection to be the nominee for Attorney General, the top law enforcement officer in America. A critical job moving forward. There's an ethics investigation of Matt Gaetz that began in April 2021. That's a while ago, into allegations of sexual misconduct and illicit drug use, allegations he unequivocally denies. The Ethics Committee appears poised to make some final decision on that report, and when they were poised to do so, Gaetz quit. Now he's no longer under the jurisdiction of the House Ethics Committee. They have no more jurisdiction over him, which means that report could be thrown in the circular file. In fact, the House Speaker would like to see it remain buttoned up and locked down because he says it would be a break of protocol for the Ethics Committee to release something on somebody who's no longer under their jurisdiction. But the senators who would vote to confirm Matt Gaetz as Attorney General want to read what's in that report to see if it causes any concern, any further concern for his nomination to be top law enforcement officer in America. Mm. That's the standoff we face between now and whenever confirmation hearings begin.
Yeah, and just a final question, Scott, here. Maybe I didn't hear you clear enough. So can the Senate members get a look at this report, even though it's not officially released or not?
Oh, they're going to try. They don't have any prescriptive way to force the House to turn it over, but they can ask and put pressure on the House to share a copy. Let me tell you, Congress leaks like a sieve, but the least leaky ship on the waters is the House Ethics Committee. They're pretty buttoned up. This is uncertain moving forward.
Interesting. Scott McFarlane, CBS News. Scott, once again, thanks. Appreciate the time, and we'll chat down the road. Thanks.
Anytime.
All right, thanks. Scott McFarlane there, CBS News. Yeah, Paul Pacelli here joining us, as he does right around this time or so, right around quarter past every Monday, is our buddy from the Connecticut NewsJunkie.com, CTNewsJunkie.com, and, of course, Substack.com, the blog Red Meat for Mushy Moderates. Terry Cowgill is here. Terry, good afternoon, sir, and how are you?
Not too bad, thank you. I'm finally adjusting to life in Texas.
Yeah.
And I now know what the railroad commissioner does. It has nothing to do with the railroads, ironically enough. I know where the best barbecue is.
Nice.
And I look at all the people who work in retail in Texas. It's unbelievable. They'll drop what they're doing to help you out. They will walk you over to the item you're looking for. And I'm thinking, wow, you know, I'm not in Connecticut anymore.
Just like Connecticut, huh?
That's right, yeah.
You mean, let me guess, Terry, and having been to other parts of the country doing play-by-play years ago, like people actually look at you in those establishments, they smile, right? They're enthusiastic.
Yeah.
They actually want to be part of a sales decision or a purchasing decision you make. It's amazing once you get out of the Northeast, isn't it?
Well, it is, and I don't want to badmouth everyone who works in the Northeast in retail. Some of them are very nice, too.
Yeah.
But on the average, they're just much better here, and they're just better at their jobs. So it's a pleasure going shopping, I will say that.
Absolutely. So you got a couple of pieces this week. This Matt Gaetz thing. See, I think there's an alternative thing here, and I buy into the – I buy Terry Cowgill into the – a theory that he was picked by Trump to make sure, and as a thank you for his support, that pretty salacious, from what we hear and the leaks tell us, House Ethics Committee report never sees the light of day. You buy that or not?
I think somebody will leak it eventually. There's too much demand for it, and there's too many people who have access to it. Because it wouldn't be just members of the ethics committee. I'm sure there are staffers who have access to it.
Mm-hmm.
I really think it'll come out, or at least portions of it will come out. And, you know, I have a whole theory now about this this blizzard of retrograde nominations that Trump has made for people in his cabinet. Yeah. And I really think now that what he's doing is he's throwing out three or four really awful picks. In the hope that the Senate and the media focus on the worst one, and then the other ones, who in a normal world would also have problems getting confirmed, they just sail through because the other ones, the three or four worst, are just so bad that everybody's going to focus on them, and the others will just kind of fall by the wayside, and they'll just get confirmed. I think that's what's going on.
So who are you putting on the Mount Rushmore of bad Trump picks here?
Well, you know, the worst, certainly, you know, the most clownish one is Matt Gaetz.
Okay.
Because he's manifestly unqualified, plus he has all of these problems and ethics investigations and all-night sex parties and where there were drugs. I mean, I can't even imagine what a boneheaded pick that was. Tulsi Gabbard, who's, you know, she's not a stupid person at all, but she clearly... I mean, to put her in charge of intelligence when she has sided with the Russian leader, she went over to Syria and cozied up to a murderous dictator there who gassed his own people. I really have a lot of problems with that one. Hegseth, Pete Hegseth the Pentagon defense secretary, you know, he's a smart guy. He served his country ably, I think it was in the Marines. But you know, he has all of these. He has a messy personal life, like a lot of people who are close to Donald Trump.
Yeah.
But this is the world's largest bureaucracy, the Pentagon.
Yeah,
that's how big it is.
$800 billion
budget, something like that.
Yeah,
and yet he's never run anything of any size. And I don't understand the logic of putting somebody like that in there either. And, of course, RFK, too, brings a lot of baggage, too. So, but those are the worst. The others will probably sail through, although in a normal world, there might be serious questions raised about them, too.
Also, why did Connecticut GOP folks you wanted to talk about do so poorly in the election? Now, the raw numbers, Terry, they're not that bad. In fact, the one state Senate race, there's a couple of state Senate races still in doubt here, one in the Yukon area and another one somewhere else in the state. And the Dems gained about four or five state House seats, which may give them a veto-proof majority. But what were your thoughts on what you read about and saw around the state this past cycle?
Yeah, I think the problem, for the most part, is candidate quality. They can attract some decent candidates for a state representative and Senate.
Yeah.
But the statewide offices, I mean, how long has it been since a Democrat won a statewide election?
Yeah.
Was it Jody Rell in 2010?
Probably, yeah, if you look back, yeah.
I think that was probably it. And so, you know, a lot of times, almost every governor, in fact, I did a little research on this for a column I wrote for TT News Junkie. Dan Malloy was the first governor of Connecticut going back over 100 years, because I actually went back more than 100 years.
Yeah.
He's the first governor never to have served in the General Assembly.
Andrew, wow.
And then Lamont, of course, he was the second one never to have served in the General Assembly. But none of them had vaulted directly from the General Assembly and into the governor's mansion. They did something else between General Assembly and becoming governor. And that's the problem, is the only high-profile Republicans in the state right now represent an individual House or Senate district.
Yeah.
They're not well-known statewide. And the only way they're going to get control of the governor's mansion again is to get somebody elected to statewide office, I believe.
And
they got to do that.
Yeah, and the problem, Terry, is, and I think you and I have talked about this before, listen, you have candidates out there that would get statewide support, like, for instance, a Themis Claridis, or going back, people forget, in the first election year for Ned Lamont, which was 2018, Mark Boughton actually won the party endorsement there, and he got gonged at a primary. And there is still, even in Connecticut, this uber-conservative cadre of Republican voters. And you Republicans out there, don't scream at me. I'm a registered Republican. We've gone to the mat about this. Who think this is Alabama or Louisiana and not Connecticut. And that holds the state GOP party back as well.
No, the only part of Connecticut that's like Alabama with snow is portions of eastern Connecticut. You know, those are... You'll see a lot of Trump signs and stuff there.
Okay.
But in general, no, I would tend to agree with you. But, you know, it does look like Aaron Stewart is running for governor. And, you know, I think they need to find somebody like Charlie Baker in Massachusetts.
Yes.
A moderate Republican who is electable, a technocratic kind of guy with a good record, who can come in and block the left-wing legislature from their worst impulses. You know, veto some stuff, really challenge it, try to shake things up. And Charlie Baker did that.
Yeah.
And but you're never going to do that unless you nominate someone who is electable. And I think Aaron Stewart is electable. I think she has those bona fides. She's not going to excite the base, the MAGA base, for sure. But maybe they're going to have to hold their nose and vote for her.
Well, yeah, maybe. But in the past, they haven't. And lastly, Terry, in about the minute we have left, you and I had a giggle. We were talking on email here.
Yeah.
Joe and Mika, who were calling Donald Trump just short of Stalin, Mussolini, Pol Pot, Chairman Mao, and Genghis Khan. Well, they had a little dinner the other night, I guess, at Mar-a-Lago, didn't they?
Yeah, and you know, it's been all the talk on social media, and people are castigating them and stuff. And yeah, I don't think it looks good because they were so harshly critical of him. But I think the proof is in the pudding. I want to see what their coverage is like of Trump going forward. And if they change their coverage as a result of this meeting, then it will really look like they sold out and the top brass came to them and said, look, you're both making $20 million a year. You're not going to be making $20 million a year if we keep losing viewers like this. And so if their coverage changes, then I will join the chorus and say, this looks really bad for them, and they deserve to lose even more of their audience.
Terry Cowgill joins us. Terry, be good. Have a great week, and we'll chat next week. Thank you, sir.
Thank you very much, Paul. Look forward to it.
Appreciate it. Terry Cowgill there with his Texas outlook, and also still covering the state of Connecticut as well.